Hello, welcome to Research Matters, exploring high-quality research methods and design in the fields of business, management and law. Brought to you by Russ Glennon, Steve Wynn, Stephen Buzz Duggan and Catherine Roycroft. Hello and welcome back to Research Matters, where we take an inside look at how we design high quality research in the fields of business management and law. As per usual, I've got Steve with me here today, and we're going to have a bit of a probably wandering, meandering conversation. I maybe think today, Steve. We've jumped over a couple of, I'm going to mangle my metaphors here. We've jumped over a couple of significant fences with ontology and epistemology, and you know, those I think often leave people feeling a little bit dazed and confused. Probably sounds like I'm now also trying to fit in song lyrics to what I'm saying, which is a great game. I might have to try that as we go. So we're walking through, I think we're opening up the interior thought processes of how we probably, and how the books suggest that we design research, and having spent some time inwardly reflecting or navel gazing or contemplating or whatever we might want to call it on what sort of a mind you have and how you kind of see the world and how you think we can access information, I think we're probably at the point now of starting to move towards what sometimes gets called operationalizing the research. So we're not going to be talking today, I don't think, about the mechanics of going and working in organizations, researching or interviewing or that sort of thing. But we're thinking about maybe how we move from an intellectual position towards a plan of action. I suppose, does that make sense as maybe the next stage for us, Steve?
I think it does actually. It was interesting, your sort of your bundle of metaphors made me think about almost orienteering from this point onwards. We've still got a sort of a research landscape ahead of us. We still have an idea of which direction we want to head in, perhaps. So now we understand our ontological position and our epistemological position, and we want to fuse that and integrate that into a methodology, and then think about the methods that we can use to take that, as you say, that more sort of intellectual position into a concrete set of actions that we're going to follow. And maybe it's a little bit like by orienteering through the landscape, where we know how to decide, how we decide which direction we should head in, what type of terrain we're interested in traversing, what sort of destination points we're looking for. But we still have to then think about how do I take that first step now? So we've got the theory, but what about the practice? And as you say, it's not practice as in the detailed interview techniques or whatever it may be, but more that thinking about translating methodology into a story about how we are going to collect data, how we are going to some extent, interpret data as well, because there will be a close link between our sort of research design and our eventual data analysis. I don't know if that helps sort of interpreting those metaphors, does it? Adding in some new.
Once again, Steve, you take my kind of inner meanderings and you turn it into something that sounds much more thoughtful and sort of possessed of a sense of logic and coherence. This is why I like working with you. No, I think that to me makes perfect sense. And we've used this metaphor of the journey, I think, a few times, and it's at the risk of sounding a little bit X Factor, that journey is important, and it's particularly important for the initial primary audience of this podcast, which, as we said a few times now, are PhD students in the early stages, the formative stages of their doctoral projects. And I think that notion of it's not all about the destination. Destinations are important to a certain extent, but always, I think, considerably less important than people, initially feel. What is important as well is, where do you start from? So, if we wanted to get to London, it makes a big difference as to whether we're in, Milton Keynes or Harrow or Liverpool or Edinburgh, the ways in which we would go there, even if you were taking the same form of transport, the train from Milton Keynes and the train from Liverpool. Sometimes they're the same train. They take quite a long difference in time, though. You need different things with you. So I think that sense of, how do we turn the signposts that we've given ourselves, or the marker points that we've given ourselves so far, how do we extrapolate that, you know, draw a line out through into a likely destination, and then take account of the landscape, the terrain in front of us? You know, to continue mangling metaphors, you know, is it hilly, is it boggy, is there a road, is there a path, can we cycle it, train, car, whatever it would be. I think that's really, really helpful. And again, we probably have said this several times, but one of the risks, I think, with some people in terms of how they do this is the rush to start collecting data. Now, you can't keep kicking the can of data collection and you know, actually doing the quote research too far down the road. But you have to be relatively confident that you have some form of roadmap that will work for you. And as from my experience and from friends' experiences, and I'm sure from yours, that route map will change, you know, over the course of the project and stuff. Things that you know, stops on the way that you felt were important may well turn out to be not particularly important. So I think I'm liking this sense of, yeah, and I suppose, are we saying now that the phase that we're sort of thinking through is, you know, we've got a sense of starting point and a couple of the waypoints, we've got a rough sense of direction, and now we're starting to say, well, let's plan the route, let's start to think about, you know, am I walking it and do I need a good set of boots, or am I, you know, being chauffeur driven in somebody else's highly scoped PhD project limousine, and, you know, some of that stuff is done for me, you know, and again, as with all these things, no better, no worse, simply different in terms of everyone's projects. Let's take that then as our starting point for this conversation and say, I'll put something to you, I suppose, Steve. Now, one of the very traditional, I suppose in quotes, notions around research is that it should be done in the scientific method, which is very strongly centered on hypothesis testing. I suppose let's just have a think about, you know, almost literally, what do we mean by, you know, hypothesis or hypothetical deductive kind of methods? What's been your experience and your perception of some of those, maybe?
Yeah, it is. I suppose if you think about it, it's almost the sort of standard model in the public mind, put it that way, I think, isn't it, in terms of generating hypotheses or hypotheses from theoretical frameworks, effectively, or theoretical models, motivated by, I think, and as much research is, testing. So we develop an understanding of the world, a theoretical position, things we expect to see, explanations of the way phenomena both unfold and occur. And often we're particularly interested in looking at the relationships between different variables, aren't we? So, for instance, we're thinking about what's the impact on, say, investment in R&D and the presence of diversity on an executive board. So what we want to do is we have a theory. We'll come up with an idea of what we think the relationship might be, what it might depend on, and from that develop testable hypotheses. And I think that's the key, isn't it? There needs to be a hypothesis that we can state, and then we can then map that onto a data collection process and reach a conclusion based on our statistical analysis as to whether or not the data supports the hypothesis or claim that we're making. And then hopefully, therefore, our knowledge claim is that it would appear to be more likely that this relationship is important, or we've established, you know, the statistical significance of this relationship, whatever it may be. And then the idea then, I suppose, is to use that information to then perhaps refine and inform future theorization. And I think that's what a lot of people would see, sort of that sort of almost sort of TV show science is, isn't it? It's taking those theories, coming up with those hypotheses, testing them against whatever it is we've decided is empirical reality. And often that's sort of measurable, observable data, or it could be people's opinions, attitudes as well. So there's a wide range. I mean, I personally started off sort of in that mindset, looking at professions and thinking about, for instance, a very straightforward question at the time, was financial planning in the UK a profession? And it was motivated by, okay, what's the theory around professions? What are the indicator attributes? How can we test whether or not financial planning profession has these types of attributes? Interestingly, though, as you mentioned before, I started out that way, but even in that project, I actually reversed and turned the whole thing on its head and ended up approaching the problem from a different point of view. So I ended up doing both sets of research in the end, and then using them in very different ways. Does that ring true, or does that make sense to you?
It does, and I think you've touched on a point that I definitely want to come back to slightly later on, which is about multiple methods or mixed methods, which I think is kind of often misunderstood, and that different methods drive at different objectives and goals. And it's not just saying, well, I'm, you know, measuring something in numbers and I'm talking to people. They're testing very different things. So there is a sense of kind of doing that. But yeah, I think that sense of what research is very pervasive. It's almost the Daily Mail effect, isn't it? It's this ongoing ontological battle to divide everything into things that cause cancer and things that cure cancer. And I have seen beer and coffee on both sides of that equation. And that makes me relatively still comfortable drinking beer and coffee, I suppose. And I suppose we'd be saying, well, why would that really matter? Why would we be bothered about what the average person in the street thinks is research? But the cultural resonance of that as the overriding paradigm of business and management research, I think, is really important. And you said previously that not that many people would admit to being a positivist, and everyone's, you know, probably now a post-positivist, which, you know, is really a more subtle, slightly smarter version of a positivist, I think I would say. I remember giving a seminar early on in MMU, like a staff research seminar, and one of my colleagues said, well, I'm not really a positivist, Russ, but I was just wondering, you know, how you would measure that and how you would like quantify that as a phenomenon. And I had to say, sound quite like a positivist to me, if I'm honest, and that's okay. I'm doing a different thing, but that's an interesting question in and of itself. So I think what we are combating a lot in business management, and I know the legal field less well, so, you know, but I'm going to make some sweeping generalizations anyway. That's what I like to do. I think in those sorts of fields is this very, very strong emphasis that unless you are doing causal hypothesis testing or hypothetical deductive kind of approaches, then you're not doing, quote, real research. And obviously we would never agree with that. But I do think we have to acknowledge that lots of people do feel that way. Now, the reason I think I would be quite vocal about rejecting that sort of supposition is twofold, really. One is, I deeply believe in the value of qualitative, more socially constructive or interpretive research. But the second, and I do genuinely feel this, is there is a danger for some of the people who want to do that sort of research that's totally appropriate for them and their background and their projects or whatever, that they rush into saying, right, well, I've got my hypotheses now, so I just need to work out what my variables are that I'm measuring. And, you know, all research, I think, benefits from being able to take this more reflective or open up this more reflective space kind of earlier on in the project. In Easterby Smith, Thorpe and Jackson's book, they've actually now got different authors, I think. Mark Easterby Smith sadly died quite recently. You know, they say all research, we contend, gets better when you consider your philosophical and sort of theoretical positions. So I think that sense of saying, well, okay, look, hypothesis testing is completely valid as a way forward. And there are ways in which you need to do it. I'm not going to tell people how to do statistical, you know, based research and stuff. That's definitely outside my wheelhouse. But that sense of, if you are wanting to do that type of research, you're very much operating in this explanatory, causal kind of mindset. That's what you're looking for. Yes, that is very often, or I suppose almost always really, developed through associative relationships, through correlations. And then essentially, and I'll be, this statisticians everywhere will probably be throwing things at their, you know, I was about to say their radio, I'm not on radio, on, you know, on their music playing devices by me saying, essentially most of stats is just about saying, well, how likely is it that this was just a random accident? And how, you know, how much faith can we have that this is a genuine thing? Which is why I think one of the problems in how much research is communicated is some of that research that is about saying there is a correlation between higher levels of consumption of, you know, nitrogen, prepared food products and bacon and things like that, processed meat, has a higher correlation with incidences of bowel cancer. So does that mean bacon causes bowel cancer? No, what it means is there is clearly an associative relationship here, and more research now needs to be done to try and rule out other factors, confounding factors, and to establish what is the intellectual process through which we can say, well, this is how you know, nitrogen preserved products, meat products, can trigger, you know, bowel cancer. And the reality is we don't really know a lot of that stuff yet, and we're still trying to kind of feed our way through. But in this sort of very media sensed rush to well, let's say that this thing causes this other thing, you know, that's I think where some of the really poor research comes out. And, you know, the big one that kind of springs to mind is Andrew Wakefield and MMR and autism, and maybe we can talk about that. So I've sort of gone around the houses a little bit there, Steve, but I think it's important, it feels important for me to say, and for you to be saying, this stuff is real research, but it's not the only thing, I guess, that is real research. Is that, I suppose, the position that you've ended up yourself in now a little bit, maybe?
It is. And actually, if I just go back to a couple of things that you said there, just, and then I'll develop that into my point about perhaps qualitative research. I think when you look at that hypothetical deductive model, what's often, I think there's an emphasis on the data collection and analysis side, and the sort of prefacing theory. And the nuance of that theory and the explanatory power of that theory, I think, is what tends to get underplayed a little bit in the poorer examples of that style of research. So as you're saying, people get very excited about the correlations, and they get very excited about making claims about those correlations. And it's interesting when you have, I've supervised one or two quantitative research products using that particular approach. And I think what people perhaps don't always appreciate is how much, actually, if you are going to adopt that route, people will challenge your choice of variables and your proxy variables and your understanding of the theoretical relationships between those variables. And I think, so it's not, it's almost sometimes, I may be wrong here, but sometimes I think people think because it's the dominant mode of research that's conducted in business management and law, potentially as well, that in a sense it's automated. That really it's just a plug and play approach to research. Yes, obviously what we do is we come up with some hypotheses, and the question is, are they good hypotheses? Are they based in a theory which is accepted or rigorous or persuasive? And then have we analysed, as you say, all the problems about confounding factors, and maybe we've missed the entire problem? And it always takes me back to, this is my philosophy moment, if we could just focus on philosophy for one moment, I suppose, but David Hume, he thought about causality and correlation many, many centuries ago. And he always used to say the problem with causality is, which is what we're really interested in, we want to know whether A causes B, the power that links the two variables together is the one thing we can't see, we can't observe. So that's why we have to theorize. That's why we do the testing. But we're always striving after something which is actually needs a lot of interpretive thought in the end to understand what those relationships between the data might mean. And I think that's what leads into a more sort of qualitative approach to research, often motivated by thinking about, actually, there's quite a lot of issues around the phenomenon, which I think are underplayed, underexamined, overlooked. I may not be entirely happy with the theorization of these relationships. I may feel that there's something very important, which, because it can't be measured in the normal sense, is then underexamined or overlooked or just dismissed. You know, there's that classic sort of management speak thing, isn't it? You know, the only thing that matters is what can be measured, isn't it? That classic line, that idea. And I know it's not as straightforward as that with the quantitative qualitative research split, if you look at it that way. But I think that does come into it as well. I think qualitative research often deals with the elements of an experience which we haven't yet learned to measure is almost what the way people are looking to. Often you'll find quite an approach where we try to take quality and reduce it to some form of quantity so we can measure it. Does that ring true with you, Russ?
Yeah, I think very much so. So what we sometimes, I guess, will see is that people who are doing that sort of research, they put on, you know, an overcoat of confidence, as it were, because they've got tried and tested methods, and they can point to, you know, other papers and other bits of research that have done similar things, but not the same thing. And this is that notion of, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants and all of those sorts of things that actually very few people, and this is not criticism, but there are very few people in it, have them in it to do that genuinely, you know, paradigm shifting or, you know, concept forming high level kind of theory, you know, the Albert Einstein sort of stuff, or, you know, Oppenheimer or whoever. So very few people really have that in them. And that's okay, because it takes a very, very, you know, dedicated and certain type of mind. So I think definitely I've seen people, and I've reviewed a number of papers where I've said the methods seem fine. I'm not a statistician, so I can't really talk. I mean, I know what a Cronbach's alpha is, and I can talk about, you know, some of the kind of standard, you know, measures of validity and ecological validity and face validity and things like that. But I'll say that looks okay, but you've got this real problem at the beginning bit where I don't think you've fully explored what this is and thus how you can capture it. And I remember a prof saying to me, and we were talking about, you know, newspapers and newspaper agenda and stuff like that. And I think it was to do with the, you know, are you stupid if you read The Sun, or do you read The Sun because you're stupid or whatever, you know. And coming from Liverpool, I'm allowed to say that. That's not a view of MMU. If you want to go and read The Sun, I'm perfectly happy with that. Just I choose not to. And he said, well, you know, we can do this, we can test this thing, and we can perfectly control for everything. And I thought, well, look, my friend, this is where you and I part company, because I don't think you could ever perfectly control for everything. And sure, okay, that's maybe an extreme interpretation of what he meant, but I genuinely think I don't know that we can conceive of enough things and of enough of the right things and to be able to measure the right things to be able to control for enough of a certain set of variables. But particularly, I think, where people shoot themselves in the foot by attempting to have a very reductive view of a phenomenon. So this sense that, you know, anything that you can measure through a single variable, I think, is not important on its own enough to be kind of worthy of researching. And again, statisticians up and down the country probably would be hopping mad about that. But complex phenomena need a complex way of capturing, you know, their richness. If we were doing this bit in kind of slides and things, I'd be putting up now this slide I've used a few times, which it says, okay, the standard view of quality of research, very much in that positivist kind of mindset, if we take the medical kind of approach to scientific research, is to say that you've got a randomized control trial is the gold standard. That's the thing at the top that's the absolutely, you know, double-blind, randomized control trial of a particular drug or process or whatever. And then you've got meta-reviews, Cochrane reviews, and then you've got, you know, isolated, more quantitative research, until you get down to what is considered to be the weakest of forms of research in those, which are, you know, qualitative, small number, you know, rich in terms of the amount or breadth of data that they generate, interviews. And that's fine. That I think there's a sense in which if you're looking for whether a drug helps people, you know, not die from COVID, totally. Control trials, you know, I totally see the benefit for those. But if the phenomenon that you want to explore is patient experience, well, a randomized control trial is not really going to tell you a lot about that. In fact, you have to turn the whole model of that quality, you know, upside down. You put it on its head. And that is maybe this is where we start to switch over to have a think about some of the qualitative side. And it's been one of my kind of deeply held views, I suppose it's a personal hobby horse maybe, that when you try and judge qualitative research on the markers for quality in quantitative research, you've failed already, because that research simply cannot meet those tests of, you know, validity and generalizability, because they're doing something completely different. This is, I think, at the heart of what I was saying about mixed methods. So absolutely. I think there is this sense then of having to, if you want to do really good, and I've seen some brilliant quantitative research, you need a clear understanding of the theoretical field and what's going on. You need a clearly articulated sense of what the phenomena are that you want to investigate, and specifically what it is you think is happening or what it is you're going to try and capture evidence of happening. You have to have a clear sense of what are the things that you need to control for. So, you know, and by control for, we mean you build them into the statistical model so that you can rule them out as having an effect. So we might say, I don't know, age of somebody. We control for age when we talk about how much you like cats or whatever. So it's not just saying, you know, young people like dogs, old people like cats, or vice versa. So you need a lot of upfront, I guess, effort in terms of then being able to articulate a clear path and a clear sense of, well, I think A and B are causing C, and therefore what we need to do is make sure that D and E are understood, and then we're going to test to see whether this thing F is clinically effective or whatever. And that is quite different, I think, to how the pathway to operationalizing qualitative research for me takes place. So again, I suppose, are we getting to a point where we maybe start to want to move towards thinking about qualitative? And I know you said you wanted to take a turn towards that now.
Absolutely. I think in terms of qualitative research, and I think linking it back to, we began the discussion by asking, what is hypothetical or hypothetical deductive research, and what is the standard, that standard model? And I think at this point, and picking up on and sort of resonating with much of what you already said, Russ, is when you're thinking about qualitative research, it is always imperative to remember that you're still asking research questions, but it's just it sounds obvious to say, but it's a different type of research question. So as you mentioned there about turning the sort of the hierarchy of quality on its head almost when you're thinking about qualitative research. And it's because you just, thinking about the context of this particular podcast, in how do we take a step forward from our ontological and epistemological position? And I think that step forward, it has to be a longer bridge, which really is built up by that sort of research question and those focuses that we've got, those foci we have for our research going forward. Because what justifies qualitative research at the end, oddly enough, I don't think it's not an extrinsic set of markers or parameters. It's the degree to which the research, I think, can address in a meaningful way the original research question asked. Just as I think with the traditional quantitative approach, where you're testing theories by building hypotheses and collecting data and then doing your analysis. So there's a clear set of parameters about what you're trying to achieve with the research. And I think qualitative research itself is very similar in that respect. So this is where the two approaches, I think, cohere. It's just that the nature of the question is so different, because it's trying to capture or reveal or illuminate or explore a different aspect of phenomenon. And so we're still really thinking about, okay, so what is our research question when we're dealing with qualitative research, and how are they going to be framed differently? Does that make sense for us?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think what we've actually brought ourselves to a little bit here is maybe having a bit of a stopping point on how we understand research quality, and how we conceive it, how we think we can access that that information. Actually, darn it, have we gone all the way back to ontology and epistemology again? We kind of sort of have, but in a meta sense where we're applying that. So we've come, it feels like possibly almost full circle, but we're looking at this sense of quality in a meta sense about, you know, how is it we conceive quality. And I guess what we're saying is it's the same thing for all of the bits of research. You need to plan to put things in place that give you the best likelihood of achieving a quality result, whatever the data might say to you. And I think sometimes there is a focus on analytical rigor, perhaps, which is not completely unfounded. I mean, you've got to be, you know, sharp in how you analyze your data, and you know, you've got to do so in appropriate, you know, means and methods and that sort of thing. But actually, I once went on a coffee making course at a food fest. It was like a half day type thing, and their opening gambit of this the people who ran a coffee shop just has really stuck with me, which is they said, you can't make good coffee from bad coffee. So, you know, you get the quality of your beans right, and that's half of your problem, you know, kind of sorted. And that stuck with me because I think actually it's one of those kind of rules for life. You know, you generally can't make good anything from bad of the things. Sure, you can polish something up so that you can try and overcome or mitigate for some of the weaknesses. But fundamentally, what you need to do, I think, in terms of the overall research approach that you're taking, is thinking, how do I make all of the stages as good as I can make them? And by good, we mean likely to deliver a result that accords with your view of quality for your research paradigm, which is why none of this is ever a straight line. It's always, you know, a kind of messy spiraling process, I think, isn't it? Because and for anyone who's been through a PhD in a discipline where some discussion of your philosophical position has been required, and that's not all PhDs by any stretch, that you have to kind of grapple through it until everything kind of drops into place and you go, right, okay, I think the bits have lined up for me. I sort of see what I'm doing. I know I'm not doing any of this stuff over here, and that's fine. This is, you know, my kind of focus. And that sense, I think, of what quality means, you know, there's another slide I use from Caroline Ramsay, who was at the Open University and at Liverpool. But she wrote a number of the sort of handbooks and stuff that the Open University uses on particularly its MBA, which is what I was teaching on. And she has a thing I've used several times and referenced back to her, which is to say, you know, the quality of your evidence is the quality of your data plus the quality of your analysis, and actually either one of those being wrong can hull your project below the waterline and kind of cause it to sink. So let's maybe take that on a little bit and say, Steve, what I'd be really interested is in your research, or in research that you've supervised or seen, what have been things where you thought, right, that's really good. That's the tick in the box for me in terms of quality. You know, that was what I was looking for, or that was what I felt needed to be done in order to make this as likely to be effective as we could make it.
I think this may be an opportunity for me to bring in another dimension to the whole problem then. I think when we're thinking about quality, because what makes a piece of research reach a quality threshold is so contingent on the nature of the research being undertaken. I think we also need to, and this is where I think the quality comes in. I think when you have a clear sense that the author of the work has engaged with their own research community and its own standards and its own parameters for quality, I think that's what often gives you a sense of confidence. So for those people who aren't familiar with qualitative research, particularly I tend to engage in discourse analysis. Now, that's an umbrella term for lots of different things. So it's not just one particular approach. But often with discourse analysis, you certainly can't make reference to generalizability, and you're certainly not, you know, you can't cite your Cronbach alpha. All you can do is be persuasive. All you can do is convince whoever it is that's reading the work that this is an argument rooted in the data, rooted in the theory in your interpretation of the data. So it's about being persuasive, which is one aspect, but that persuasiveness is often rooted in two different dimensions. One is the transparency, in terms of the way you've presented the data, the transparency about your philosophical position, the transparency about your methods and the way you've reached your conclusions. But also, and this is a new term to introduce, communicative validity. The idea that your arguments and your ideas have also been exposed to and discussed with other fellow travelers within your research community. So it's been tested almost against that wider community, and there's been assent, there's been discussion. People have maybe suggested various ideas at conferences, but that sort of wider dissemination of those arguments. So we're almost rooting, it almost becomes like a networked notion of quality, because you've got those different people reading your work, not just your external examiners, just PhD, but that wider community. Almost as though your research is supported by, you know, is it that sort of when you look at trees in a forest, isn't it? There's that supporting network, isn't there? Of sort of fungal web, isn't there? That supports the tree life. And I think for the type of research I've done, that's been very important, because there isn't some sort of external measure that you can apply to the quality of a piece of discourse analysis. What you can sometimes see with sort of allied areas, you see content analysis, more quantitative approach. I think, Russ, you've got something to say. I can see the software's telling me.
It must be, yeah, something in my face letting you know. I just had a quick question. Sorry to cut in. So what we've just been saying, I think, is there are different criteria generally held to be the ones that we would seek for different sort of, you know, and we're now talking about qualitative versus quantitative rather than necessarily philosophical position. And validity is very much one of the ones around quantitative research. And I suppose its analog in qualitative, we might say, would be credibility. So, you know, is this a credible story that you tell? This idea about communicative validity, do you think that's something then that crosses the barrier, as it were, between quantitative and qualitative? Is that maybe that transparency, you know, maybe being a part of that, is that something that you would very much see on both sides, or does it more lend itself towards one side?
No, I think the reason I originally brought it up, but obviously we often digress, don't we, is very much because I think it is analogous to what happens in wider scientific communities, isn't it? After all, that when we look at the methods of statistical analysis, they're agreed upon. There's a consensus about what they should be. I mean, obviously there's a mathematical rigor behind them, and you can look that up in textbooks. But if we're honest, if we use them, we don't go back and look at the mathematical rigor underlying the models, do we? We accept them as part of the tools that are available for our particular research community. So I do think that notion of being connected to a pre-existing, coexisting community is really important. Whether we, as you say, that particularly applies to quantitative and qualitative analysis, but also in terms of your philosophical positions, because again, there are communities who also adopt similar sorts of philosophical presuppositions and accept certain particular sort of approaches to thinking about the nature of ontology and epistemology. And I think it's important to connect with those and not just see your, I think we've made this point before, not just see your philosophy as being something where you withdraw to determine what that position will be. Actually, it's very much, I think, should be the opposite. It's about going outwards and connecting. Yeah. Yep.
Sorry, I was just chiming in to say it's about the connection. It's about the bonding of yourself, or the integration maybe with you and, as you said, that external, that dialogue.
Again, thinking about our original question at the beginning about how do we take steps beyond epistemology and ontology into thinking about or sort of operationalizing what we're doing. From my perspective, I think probably what we're really trying to think about is, as you mentioned, quality is an issue, the research questions that we've got, and perhaps just starting to think about how are we also going to, what's our intended mode of communication? Because I think that is also very important in terms of determining what's going to be sufficiently of sufficiently high quality, but also what's going to be judged as either reliable communication or meaningful or interesting. And I think it's important to remember that your work will be judged across a range of formal and slightly less formal parameters as well. Often people, particularly qualitative research, often what people are looking for is a little bit of interest, novelty, something new that's not been explored before. I think it just opens up once you start to think about how do we operationalize. The answer is not simply by looking up, a number of steps in a textbook. That's not to say, of course, that you might not find there are particular papers which give you a roadmap. Yep. Which give you a similar sort of work, similar sort of context, allied types of questions, and gives you a pointer to the way that you're going. But I think, we have to then make sure that we apply thought processes to that decision and think about our own particular context and work.
Yeah, I really like that last term that you brought in. We're advocating, I guess, if anything, for thoughtful research, and by thoughtful we mean taking the time to engage in dialogue, scholarly dialogue, whether that is through presenting papers at conferences or seminars in your own department or whatever it will be, or actually just researching, reading into your community and drawing out some of the ideas. I always use that metaphor with students to say, in all academic writing is a conversation between you and the scholarship. It's a backwards and forwards. It's a looking for themes and patterns and contradictions and those sorts of things, gaps. So I really like that kind of sense of, how do we advocate for people to have thoughtful research? And I think one of the really unfair questions that we pose of PhD students in the very early stages is we more or less ask them to work out what it is they think they're going to know by the end of the research. And you think, well, if I knew that, what would be the point in doing any of the research? It certainly doesn't sound like it'd be novel. But I suppose what we really mean by that, I guess, is you need to have some view of what sort of position you will find yourself in and what sort of claims to knowledge are you hoping to be able to make, even if we don't know what those actual claims are, because that has to emerge from either testing your hypothesis and finding that it is or it isn't supported, or analysing, the discourses or the language used or, whatever it would be. And I think that having a sense of, know thyself, who you are and how you see the world and how you view the situation or the phenomenon that you're looking to explore, and then having the sense of, so what am I aiming to do? I'm aiming to come up with some knowledge. My contribution is going to be seeing whether this, way of constructing a building is cheaper and more energy efficient than that way of constructing a building, whatever it would be. And then you get into thinking, well, if that's what I'm trying to do, what would be the ways in which I will be judged or my research will be judged? Is it around this transparency and credibility and trustworthiness and confirmability? Or is it about, validity, generalizability, repeatability, reliability? How do we do those things? Steve, what's your view, I suppose, on pulling that back together?
I think what I really like about what you've just said there, Russ, is that notion of the knowledge claim. And now I'm going to start off by using the word evidence, but make it more problematic than it sounds. I think ultimately your knowledge claim, if you think about someone reading your work and you're making a claim about what you know, the obvious response of the reader is, okay, so what evidence is for that claim? And I think our brains default into thinking, what data is there to support the claim? And that is part of the evidence. But I think another critical component of the evidence is there a reasoned, logical route towards which that claim has been made? So it's supported by the data. It may be embedded in the data. And in certain types of research, that may be the most important aspect of the evidence or knowledge claim. But I also think the reader will want to be convinced that you've thought through the link between ontology and epistemology, methods, theory, and that all of that then coheres in the knowledge claim. So I think that's an important point to point out, that we're not just thinking about content. Here's our data. It's also form. You know, have we convinced our audience that we've used a particular process or line of reasoning or set of methods, whatever it may be, that also supports the knowledge claim?
No. Sorry, that was my that was the research cat Theo, who has just appeared. My academic research cat is lying in a bed on the desk at the moment, so it was always nice to hear his contribution about research philosophy. I find myself again completely in agreement with that, Steve. I think that the PhD is an apprenticeship. I think, and you know, as an apprentice, you know, if you were an apprentice woodworker or whatever, you'd need to show that you could do a series of things, that you could make a mortise and tenon or a dovetail joint or a lap joint or whatever it would be, or, you know, use biscuits to join bits of wood, which I always sounds really odd until you work out they don't mean an actual, you know, hobnob or whatever. So the equivalent of that in a PhD apprenticeship as a researcher is you having to do exactly that. It's the showing you're working out and showing that you understand not only what it is you're doing and why you're doing that, but why you're not doing other things, which would be perfectly fine, you know, but that you have chosen this because this is the pathway that you think leads to the research outcome with the greatest degree of quality that you think you'll be able to manage. And sometimes, and this is really hard, particularly for PhDs, sometimes that means not finding any of the stuff that you wanted to find. Now, where I think qualitative focused research tends to possibly have a slight advantage in that is if you were looking for, you know, certain phenomena you wanted to explore, sometimes you're not looking for anything. You're just going to see what's there and discuss that. But if you didn't find certain things or you know, there were relationships between concepts emerging that you'd not predicted, you've got other stuff to kind of talk about. I think if you've taken a very narrow view of a sort of more positivist quantitative research project and you don't find that hypothesis is supported, that's probably okay for a paper. And I think actually, you know, science advances by disproving hypotheses for me, not by proving them. But for a PhD, that might feel really awkward. You know, if you were looking for these correlative relationships or causal relationships between certain things and you just kind of go, well, it's not there. Actually, that's quite hard to write up. That's fundamentally, I think, one of the core reasons why this sense of charting your path so that irrespective of what the research says at the very end, you can say, you know, I followed a good and true path. So I wonder if that's a point to kind of just wrap us up there. This has been, again, really interesting. We've not been able to free ourselves from the shackles, I guess, of ontology and epistemology, but that's exactly right. You know, I was that perhaps where you thought we would end up, Steve?
Absolutely. I think all conversations, whether related to this or what I'm going to have for dinner, should end up with ontology and epistemology.
But what is fish and chips really when we think about it? No, that's excellent. So thank you again, Steve. It's been, you know, again, a really interesting conversation for me in that I always learn tons from you and you bring a philosophical thoughtfulness that I sometimes feel that I lack. So thank you for that. Next week, I think we're probably going to start moving towards considering causality and correlation, this sense of logical coherence. And way back in the 1840s, when I was doing my A levels and I was also doing an S level in French, go and ask your parents. My French teacher gave me this sheet called Les épines de la langue française, which are the thorns of the French language. What are the little things that get you hung up, that catch you and stop you making progress? And hopefully, I think we might start to think about some of those potential problems, Steve. What do you reckon?
Absolutely. I think that is the next step, isn't it? To now descend from these airy regions that we've been inhabiting and think about, okay, what are some of the more practical issues that we'll have to face, I think, going forward?
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you once again for being here, Steve. Thank you once again for listening. And you've been listening to Research Matters.
You've been listening to Research Matters, exploring what makes high-quality research from MMU Business and Law. Brought to you by Catherine Roycroft, Stephen Buzz Duggan, Steve Wynn, and Russ Glennon.